Good afternoon and welcome to Lambda Weekly. I'm Dave Taffet and I'm here in the studio with Laurent Landis. The late Patty Fink is very, very late today.
Very late.
Yeah, she'll be with us next week. Our guest today is Dolores DeLuce. I am excited to have her back. She was on earlier this year. She was talking about her book, My Life, A Four-Letter Word, Confessions of a Counterculture Diva. We had a ball.
We did.
We told her when her new book comes out, we have to have her back on. She's here with us today. Her new book, it really is G-rated, but, well, okay,
sort of.
R-rated. But the name of the book is Blowjobs, A Guide to Making It in Show Business, or not. And she doesn't list it as a how-to book. It's a how-not-to book.
How-not-to.
How-not-to. Dolores, welcome.
Hi there, David. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Hi, Dolores.
Good on this kind of gray, rainy day, unusually so in Los Angeles.
It's kind of gray here, too. It's supposed to get cold here, though, again.
It is. Another cold front.
Here. Cold for us.
Well, cold for us is like the 40s, so.
Yeah, we had 80s, like, all over the holiday and everything.
Yeah, we did, too. Not 80s, but 70s. It was really nice. Did you have a nice Thanksgiving?
Yeah, it was great. I had 101 fever, and I cooked for 2 days with it on top of the 80-degree temperature.
Oh, no.
Well, that sounds like something you would do.
It was quite memorable. The meal turned out great, and none of my guests died of any kind of diseases. So
yeah. Well, that's always good.
Well, I guess whatever I have is just with me, okay. my sick body. But anyway, it was fun anyway. I had family from all over the place showing up. It was great, yeah.
Now, one of the things I loved about your book, one of the last chapters is titled I Was a Bimbo Slave and More Jobs That Suck. Your book very much is about all of the different awful things that you've done. Some of them awful, some of them a lot of fun, actually.
Not that bad, yes.
Right. Now, here's the line where you and I are soulmates here. Now, I believe in that self-help book that says... wait a minute. Let me put my glasses on.
I know what it is. You're going to say, do what you love and the money will follow.
Exactly.
Yes.
And then you say, but I'm still waiting.
Right.
Me too.
Yeah, you too. And, you know, everyone thinks we're very successful when they see us on the radio or hear us on the radio or see us on Facebook. But, you know, underneath the awful truth.
Uh-huh. Right. For me, it's one article that I write after another.
Hey.
They're always, yeah. But it's like, oh,
exactly.
It always does. Yeah. Uh-huh.
What they don't realize is you've put in the time.
Exactly. Yeah. Lots of time.
Now.
And little money in my bank account.
Yeah. But that was one of the things that Laurent was saying before the show. We were just talking a little bit about the book. And I was saying that, you know, he's married to his husband, and they have an almost six-year-old daughter. She'll
yes.
be six
yes.
this month.
Yeah.
Now they
great.
Have a, yeah. So now you raised, so you can give all kinds of great parenting advice to Laurent, and your advice is the advice I want him to follow.
He needs to read the chapter called "Bad Mommy."
Uh-huh. Exactly.
Yeah, we'll get to that.
Well, you know, there were times that you had these terrible jobs. You dragged your daughter along. She didn't know until later that not everybody has a stripper at their Sweet 16 party. But you did what you could, and you worked real hard. And that's like Laurent also, always working hard. He would never let anything happen to his daughter. So while you're saying bad mommy, by certain standards, do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
Of course, yeah. By a lot of people's standards.
Well, but you know, can we live by those standards?
I can't. Well, one of the things that we talked about, I always listening to your story, reading your story, it just kind of reminded me of something that Whoopi Goldberg has always talked about. You know, when she was paying her dues before she made it big, you know, she was a single mother also with a daughter, and she took her from literally from city to city because, you know, Whoopi was part of all these different theater companies getting
right,
paid nothing.
Yeah.
And, you know, she's very frank about that, how it was very difficult, and she doesn't regret it, but her daughter did pay a price for it before she hit it big and, of course, started the millions coming in. So I wanted your take on that. What was it like?
Before your millions started coming in.
Yeah, well, my daughter is still hoping that my millions will come in. I'm waiting for her millions to come in. see which one of us gets there first.
Right.
No, I think it makes a big difference if you've, you know, succeeded according to the world standards and you haven't. You know, I mean, my daughter is grateful for the creative, open, loving, you know, non-judgmental lifestyle I provided her to be her own artist, because she knows, you know, it really was great for her to grow up in that environment. But then, like I also say in that chapter, she also has, you know, not so much anymore now that she's like 44, but as she was getting in her young adult years, she had resentments because, like any kid, doesn't matter how you raise them, they're going to grow up thinking that they didn't do what they needed, right?
That they missed out on something.
Yeah, there was, you know, some of those things that, in hindsight, if I could go back and do something different around the way, say, I dragged my daughter into certain situations, I would change if I could. But overall, I don't regret the general ambiance of the environment I provided for her in my insanity, you know, because there was a lot of good that came out of it as well.
Sure, and she's very successful now.
Yeah, well, she's successful the way I'm successful. She looks great to the public eye. But, you know, she still doesn't have enough money to produce her own album. She keeps running off to Asia every few months so she can earn a decent living as a singer, because when she comes back to the United States, it's slim pickings for actual good gigs, you know, mm-hmm. paid decently. So it's a struggle. She's actually going back to graduate school in January to get a degree in music so she can have a secondary career as a music teacher, you know.
Okay.
That kind of thing. But she is successful. I mean, anyone that hears her, sees her, you know, she's stunning. She's a great performer, singer. Mm-hmm. And it's all relative. Like, you know, we say, you know, what's the definition of success, mm-hmm. you know? In America, of course, success means, you know, you earn a decent living from the choices that you make, but not always when you're an artist.
But this is where I identify with you so much. You couldn't uh-huh. take a job that you, well, you did take jobs that you really hated. I've had some of those too.
Right, but mostly I kind of held out to do what I wanted to do as right. much as possible. Yes, you're right.
Exactly. I love when you're talking about your file clerk job in New Jersey, because I had one of those before I came back to the newspaper. Tell a little bit about that one, and I'll tell you about my awful job.
Yeah, I had actually lived in Los Angeles for a whole year. I moved out when I was 19, and I talk about that in the first book. But 1 year into my stay in Los Angeles, I hit hard times. And at the same time, my mother was itching for me to come home, and my mother is a big drama queen, so she created this disease. You know, she had a heart condition, and the doctors were very concerned. And, oh, please come home, Dee. We, you know, who knows what's going on. So I thought, well, okay, you know, I'll come home and I'll regroup and figure it out, you know. Mm-hmm. I get home, of course, my mother announces that, yay, the doctors told me all I had was a bad case of gas. She really doesn't have a heart disease. She just had to burp. So that was my mother. And so once I was back home, you know, I didn't have enough money to leave to come back to California. Mm-hmm. So I had to find a job, and I ended up in this job where a friend of mine worked called the Fisher Chemical Company. God knows if they're still there. They used to be on Route 20 in, I think, Fairlawn, New Jersey, which was the town right next to Paterson, New Jersey, where my family lived. This was about 1968 or 9. I'm not sure exactly of the year. So I'd go to work every day, and they'd basically send me to the warehouse in the back and with stacks and stacks of these files on all the chemical research that their chemists were doing, and I'd have to file them appropriately. And it was just grueling. It was so boring mm-hmm. and horrible. So little by little, I just started carrying a big purse to work, and I would take as many files that would fit in that big purse, and at lunch hour, I'd go out of the building, take them out, and then find a big dumpster and dump them. And at the end of the day, I would do the same. So it would alleviate my workload.
Wow.
And nobody ever looked for those files?
No,
or you were gone by the time?
No one ever knew that happened, as far as I know. I mean, maybe after I left. They eventually fired me. They had a reputation of never firing anyone. They had a they were very lenient and generous company. You know, you got unlimited sick days, which I took full advantage of. I went to Florida once for 2 weeks pretending to have a severe flu in January, and I came back to work brown as could be.
Well, wait a minute. Unlimited sick days? Are they hiring now? What's their number?
And then after that, the reason why they fired me was, you remember when Donovan wrote that song, they call it Mellow Yellow?
Sure.
Quite rightly. Uh-huh. Call it Mellow Yellow. Uh-huh. It was people who had this fad. They used to, like, scrape the inside the peel of a banana and bake it, and they said if you smoke it, you'd get high. So I decided one day to try it, and I had a banana for lunch, and so I took the peel into the back where the chemists worked. They had their own little area, and I asked the chemist if they would bake the banana peel for me. And then I, you know, later on that day, I just, as a goof, I was running around the office wearing a Chiquita banana sticker on my third eye and my forehead. And by the end of the day, my supervisor came over and he fired me, and he said that they knew I was selling drugs on the premises, and that if I would leave quietly and just go, they wouldn't file charges and call the police.
Oh, my.
That's how they got rid of me. But they never busted me for the, you know, the fake. I actually pretended to faint in the bathroom to take that 2 weeks off, you know, so I could say that I was severely sick. You know, I pretended to faint in the bathroom till somebody came and found my body on the floor. I mean, I did so many things in that company, you know, and they never fired me for any of them. But the one thing that I did, which was bogus, you know, they fired me.
That one they got you for.
Yeah.
But, I mean, we've all had those tedious, tedious jobs. My
right.
last job before going back to work at the newspaper was editing financial reports that had to be filed with the Securities and Exchange Commission. They had to be filed by 7 a.m., so we were reading this garbage at, like, 4 in the morning.
Oh, how horrible.
Oh, God.
Sounds
every time
exciting.
I tried, oh, every time I tried to quit, they gave me more money. And, you know, so I couldn't quit. And after 2.5 years, all of a sudden, the business started dropping off, and so I got laid off.
I'm sure.
Everybody else, that your little instant message light came on. And so one by one, they were bringing people to the back room to tell them that they were part of the layoff. Mine went off, and I jumped out of my chair. And then I looked at all these people sitting around me who were really depressed, and I hung my head. I said, oh, I'm next. And I walked to the back, and they said, you know, this is the severance package, and you don't have to sign it right now. You can bring it back. I said, no, I don't want to ever come back to this place again. I'll sign. Where do I sign?
Great. Just give me my money, and I'm leaving.
Yeah. Oh, God, I hated that job. I just hated it.
Oh, my God. But, I know. I can't do those kind of jobs for very long. I mean, I literally, you know, just get, like, horrible things happen to me. Like, one time I was more than once I was a telemarketer, and I literally, I'd want to put a gun to my brain at the end of the day. It was, it just, like, would kill me to do that kind of stuff.
I'm right there with you.
Yeah, it was horrible, and I don't know how people survive and do it. I guess, you know, luckily I was clever enough to find other ways to make, you know, ends meet, but, you know, it's always been touch and go, and I've had to be willing, you know, to live with nothing and be so on the edge, you know, and it's kind of, you know, as the older I get, the more frightening life becomes when you're living on the edge and you have no security.
Right.
It really does, but for some reason, I realized, you know, a few years ago when I would get anxiety about it, you know, what options do I have? You know, either I keep pursuing my dreams in the creative world and pray and hope that somebody will find one of my books and decide they would make great, you know, material for films and TV series, which they would,
you
know.
Oh, they would.
And, or, you know, I'll get lucky and book that, you know, Where's the Beef commercial, you know, like the money maker, which I'm always, you know, because I still act and I still, you know, I do all those things. But it's just that none of it has ever, you know, brought me any real financial. And it may never happen, you know, and who knows? I mean, I may end up, you know, I just hope I never end up in a shopping cart on a bookfire in Venice.
We wouldn't let that happen to you.
No. I just have this innate trust, you know, in the universe that, it never will, and you know, and it never does. You know, in the 11th hour, something always, like recently, I got a job from a woman who's, you know, quite wealthy, and she wants to self-publish. She's been writing books, but she's never had the guts to self-publish like I did. Mm-hmm. And a friend of hers told me about me, you know, me and my success with self-publishing my two books, and she hired me to consult her. And in the process of consulting her with her material, she ended up also hiring me to edit her newer book. And so right now I have a job for today, you know, but who knows what's going to come next month or the month after that. I never know, you know.
You know, but don't you think, because I'm this type of person, that if I had to do the same thing every day like I was doing when I was editing those financial reports,
right?
You know, I don't care how interesting it is to start. After a while, you want to tear your hair out.
You do.
I couldn't do one of those jobs. We need to take a break. Dolores, stick with us. We're going to be back with more Lambda Weekly on 89.3 KNON FM. I'm Dave Taffet here in the studio with Laurent Landis. We'll be back with more Lambda Weekly right after this.
Hi, this is Patty Fink, and you're listening to Lambda Weekly on 89.3 KNON FM.
And I'm Dave Taffet here in the studio with Laurent Landis, the late Patty Fink, who you just heard. Is not here today. She is in Louisiana with Aaron at her family's house
for Thanksgiving.
Yeah, we're talking to Dolores DeLuce. She's a little bit of everything, but right now we'll just call her an author. Her new book is Blowjobs: A Guide to Making It in Show Business or Not. And Dolores, where is your book available?
Well, right now you can mostly get it on Amazon.com, you know, in paperback and in Kindle. Or you could go directly to my website, www.deluce. No, not that's the other way. That's the other business. See how I wear too many hats. CountercultureDiva.com.
Okay, CountercultureDiva.com.
Yeah, and but you can get that has a link to them. But mm-hmm. there's a couple of stores that carry it. If you're in San Francisco, and I don't know, you might be listening to this, but still live in San Francisco, the Green Arcade Bookstore is carrying it. I did a reading at Book Soup. They might have some in Los Angeles on Sunset. You know, you could ask your local bookstore. But I think the quickest, easiest way is just to go directly to Amazon and get it. It's probably cheaper that way, too. You know, I know I like to support the small bookstores, you know, the ones, but not that many of them carry it. You know, that's the problem.
Right.
Some of them don't let you do readings at their stores. They think Amazon is the evil empire. So, but, mm-hmm. you know, what's a poor girl to do if she's right. got to self-publish?
Dolores, you talk about your pursuit of dreams in a creative world. So, yeah, obviously, that has taken you through a lot of different jobs. But was there one in particular job in the creative world that you wanted, that you were aiming for, to be an actress or anything?
Well, none that I actually aspire to, but some that came to me accidentally that I would say were quite rewarding on some levels. The one chapter here I have in the book, not only were there jobs, there were also businesses that I started. So there was a variety of things that I did. It's like 12 chapters, and they're all named something in relationship to what I did in terms of work. But the one chapter four is called Made for This, and that's the story about the 2 years I worked as Dean Martin's housekeeper. Mm-hmm. And that is quite a story because in that 2 years I had some fabulous events that occurred while I worked for Dean, and everyone loves that story whenever I read it. One of the ones I read in public when I do readings in my book because people just adore it. And over the course of all the other careers and businesses I started, I've, you know, brushed up against many, many high-profile celebs. You know, I mean, Dean was one of the gods. You know, he was just a total sweetheart. Mm-hmm. And I say some nice things about him, but it's a very funny story in relationship to where we both were at that point in our lives. Mm-hmm. You know, when I was in his house, I was still, you know, building props for my one-woman show and running off to auditions and doing all these things right under his nose, you know, by the pool while he took naps, you know, with the aids of his Valium and what have you. So there's stories like that.
Right, and he would just say to you, if anybody called for him, oh, just tell him I'm off playing golf. You know, so.
Tell him I'm golfing. Yeah, yes, right. He'd always say, good morning, dear. Well, please hold all my calls. If they ask where I'm, tell them I'm golfing. He was hysterical. He was. I won't tell the story because I want people to go and get the book and read it about what happened when he went out on tour with the Rat Pack for their second coming when they were all older.
Yeah.
I don't know if you remember that,
yes.
But and he took ill. And so I have a bit of the story about what happened when he came home and reported to me what really happened.
Right, because it was not what was reported in the press.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. But I've had so many, I was the knitter to the stars, and still am, actually, technically, although I'm not doing as much of that selling. But
Okay, now this was the thing that struck me about your being the knitter to the stars, and she made sweaters.
Sweaters, that was sweaters. How Renee Taylor would speak to me.
How fast do you knit?
The lady. Well, by hand, I'm pretty fast, but I also have a knitting machine, and a lot of my designs were combinations of things that I could do partially on the machine and then partially by hand. Like, I actually had accounts all over the country in the 80s with Saks Fifth Avenue and Bergdorf Goodman's and Bendel's in New York, and I did that for 2 seasons, but I had no investor money, and I couldn't keep the ball rolling because it got more and more difficult to produce the knits and the samples for the reps in New York and Los Angeles and, then get the orders filled. And, oh, my God, it was
just I'm amazed that you were even able to make enough sweaters for somebody like Renee Taylor to come along and take a look at them and say, okay, I'll take this one.
If you came to my house right now, I will open my closet door in the hallway. Mm-hmm. Out will fall at least, the IKEA bags, those big giant bags? I have 5 of those filled to the brim. I always have an inventory every fall of about 30 to 40 sweaters going in, women and adult, and some baby stuff too, because I'm a compulsive knitter. I sit and knit for hours as I watch hours of television. It's like a dual I don't know, what's the word, productivity.
Yeah.
I get to research my craft of acting and good programming and writing and production values on television while I frantically knit, beautiful pieces.
See, my experience with knitting is my mother decided she was going to take up knitting at one point, and so one of the things that she started with was sweaters. And I don't know what happened to this one sweater, because this was years ago. My mother's gone for 40 years already. So, but there was one sweater, I wish I had it, that she made for me, and it took months. One arm was longer than the other. It was a shawl collar, and the shawl was much wider on one side than the other.
Right.
And because she had knitted tighter on one side. And we were hysterical with that, but it took her months to make this one sweater.
Too
funny. I know. Well, that's why, beginners shouldn't start knitting sweaters. they should start with scarves and gradually work their way up to a sweater. But when I was a kid, I learned how to knit, and I never made anything, fabulous either. I mean, I knitted scarves or whatever. But then I didn't do it, and I did it once for when I was 13 or 14. I made a sweater for my first steady boyfriend, Augie Matarazzo, his name was, little Italian gangster, and it wasn't as bad as your mom's sweater, but it was a little off. It wasn't perfect. It was like one of those off-white crew neck sweaters in the 60s, and so he looked like he was happy to have it at Christmas, and then I never saw him wear it through the holidays. I never saw him, New Year's Eve, I never saw him wear it. So I finally asked him, I said, where's the sweater I made you? Have you had a chance to wear it yet? And he looked at me and says, oh, I'm so sorry. No, my mother put it under the tree and our dog ate it.
Oh.
that was it. Augie got his walking paper. So I don't think I knit another sweater until the 70s, and then I made a few. And then by some fluke in 1980, I was going to some special event. And I saw a sweater in the shop on Rodeo Drive, some really fancy boutique, and it had, it was like little black cotton tank top, kind of little cap sleeves. It was almost like a T-shirt, but it was black knitted, but it had these purple fluffy clouds floating through it that were knitted in at 100% French Angora. And I don't know if you remember the styles of the 80s, but there was this style of knits that were, they call it intarsia, where they would put Angora against the flat yarn so it would pop out like a design.
Mm-hmm.
And I just looked at the sweater. It was just so beautiful. And I thought, I've looked at the price. It was $350 in 1980, right? You know, like that was a fortune.
Wow. Yeah.
And I thought, well, maybe I could make it. And I went to the yarn store and I bought some black, simple black cotton and a couple of balls of this very expensive 100% French Angora in purple. And I just went home and I knitted it, like without a pattern, just out of my vision of what it looked like in the window of the shop. And it turned out flawless. I mean, it was so adorable and cute. And I wore it with a, you know, a 50s black taffeta circle skirt to this party. And I have two friends that are fashion designers back then that were fairly successful. And one of them was there, and she saw it, and she flipped out. She said, "Where'd you get that sweater? It's so fabulous." "Honey, I made it." She said, "You're kidding. You know how to do this?" She immediately said, "Do a few more and go to this store and go to that store." And before I knew it, overnight, I had stores in L.A., you know, West Hollywood, all over ordering sweaters.
Mm-hmm.
And then my other fashion designer friend who was like a, actually I have a story in here about him, Clifford Olson. He used to do stuff for Tina Turner and Aretha, and he started out North Beach Leather and Suede, and then he had his own business for years. He was very helpful in mentoring me, and he ended up bringing me into his fashion reps, you know, and next thing I know, that's how I was selling all over the country. And it just, like, happened overnight,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
I never realized I even had this knack of knowing how to design and knit without a pattern. But whenever I tried to follow a pattern, I didn't do it very well because I'm dyslexic, and it would always come out weird, you know. But when I can do it just from my own vision, and also as a kid, I learned how to sew, so I had a sort of an understanding of the shapes of garments because of cutting patterns, you know, when you're little and you learn how to sew a blouse or this or that. So that's how I would kind of like just knit the shapes and then sew them together, and they turned out to be pretty fabulous.
Dolores, I want to talk to you about L.A. I know Los Angeles, Hollywood is, you know, considered like the entertainment capital of the world. Everybody who has any dreams to make it big in whatever field it is, they think they need to be there. Was there any times in the midst of your experiences that you thought, you know what, I need to get out of L.A. Maybe this isn't for me?
Well, you know, before I started seriously seeking a career in L.A., you know this from the stories in my first book, I ended up in San Francisco performing. And that, too, was sort of accidental in a way, because that was when I met Divine, and then Divine and I became really good friends, and then he mentored me. And the next thing I know, you know, he suggested I work in a Coquette show in San Francisco. So based on that job that I got, you know, performing with the Coquettes in 1973, I moved to San Francisco for 4 years, and that's really where I got my chops. You know, that's where I learned to act on stage, and I started writing with, you know, the collectives that I worked with and that kind of thing. But then once I came back to L.A., you know, because I felt like San Francisco was limited, like I can only keep performing in the underground, you know, and I wanted to really reach a bigger audience. So I moved back to Los Angeles by the end of the 70s, and that's when I started to pursue, you know, the Hollywood dream.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of where this book picks up. And so I don't think I ever felt like I had to get out of L.A. for any reason, you know, in terms of, but I love to travel. I mean, you know, since my daughter's been older in the last 10 years, I've traveled all over Asia to be with her at different exotic countries where she was singing and things like that. So, but not really feeling like I had to get out of L.A. to make it in some sort of way.
Yeah.
You know, if that's what you meant.
Yeah. And in the film business, if you want to make it, you need to go there. Because I know in my...
Especially back then.
Well, I think even now. Because, like, with my ridiculous acting career, I've always gone, and I've done a number of these little parts, but at my age, either you did this and took those little roles when you were 20, by the time you were 25, decided, okay, I'm going to go the next step, and you go to L.A. or New York, if it's stage career,
right.
Mostly. But those little roles, and I kept getting them. And do you remember, Laurent, I went a full year, and every week I said, okay, if I don't get anything this week, I'll look for a job. Okay, if I don't get anything
this
week.
And you kept getting it.
And for a full year, I got something. And they were all little jobs. But I wasn't up against very many people because, you know, when I was in my 50s and, you know, and people in their 50s aren't going for those real little, you know, just.
They nice. Are now.
Yeah, but not yeah. here. Not here in Dallas is what
oh,
I'm saying.
So you did this in Dallas.
I did this in Dallas.
Well, you know, that's what I mean. You know, and I have a little small.
That's what I mean. Yeah. Well, you see, that's interesting because I had a friend who I used to love to work with. We were in acting class together, and he was very funny and talented. He ended up moving to Santa Fe, mm-hmm. and because back in those days, I mean, it's quite a while now, maybe 20 years ago, he's been there since then, he started working like gangbusters as an actor, whereas here, he couldn't get arrested, you know, mm-hmm. he couldn't even get a little part, you know, and he started getting, you know, because they do a lot of production in Albuquerque and all that, because he was a union actor, you know, he would get chosen all the time to work, and so he was happy that he moved to Santa Fe, and then he ended up, you know, starting his own carpentry business, and so he's had a very healthy life, you know. He works, he has his own business, and he works as an actor whenever he can, and so, yeah, but I've never thought of moving out of L.A., or I like living, well, L.A. is not as urban as even as a city that I like, you know, because I love, like, cities where you can take a subway, like New York and
sure.
Chicago right. or, you know, San Francisco. But there's something about L.A., you know, like the weather and the fact that I live right on the beach and I can see the ocean from my apartment keeps me in L.A. You know,
that's hard to beat. Yeah,
I've been here for so long that, you know, for me to change gears and try to live in another city would be difficult unless I had a lot of money, you know. If I had money, I'd have an apartment in New York, too, you know.
Oh, sure.
And that's what I meant about the acting thing, David. Like, long time ago, you kind of had to be in L.A.
Mm-hmm.
Now there are opportunities to make it other places, especially in TV. There's so many TV shows that aren't filmed in L.A. anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they go all over.
They
yeah.
go all over, especially Canada. People don't know some of the shows are filmed in Canada, but they are.
And also some of it, like in North Carolina. I mean, there's a
mm-hmm.
lot of people that give tax incentives, and that's
right.
why we have such a bad economy here in California, especially in the film industry. Everybody from below the line to the performers suffer here. You know, unless you're a name actor already, of course, they're going to hire you and take you anywhere. But for all the lesser jobs, you know, mm-hmm. they take a skeletal crew of the big names, you know, the head designer, this and that, and then they hire local talent for all the other positions that need to be filmed, you know, hired on a film or a TV show that's being shot. So there's a lot of us now, you know, on the unemployment lines, people that worked a lot and did a lot. I have friends, you know, that were pretty, you know, up there in the costume departments and this and that. They're all struggling now because of that runaway production.
Hmm.
It's crazy that a city, you know, especially the city, but also just the state of California, if they were smart, they would do something to be competitive with these states that are offering those kind of tax breaks to bring some of that production back home here, you know?
Yeah.
Really, it's really bad. Yeah, I mean, I've noticed the decline. And also, the whole business has changed. Like, I do mostly commercial acting now. You know, all the stuff I go up for is usually just commercials. And even that business has radically lost its numbers of sheer production that happened, not just from the runaway, but from the way people advertise. You know, like, I did a commercial last year for the internet, which pays nothing practically, you know, they get to use your stuff for a whole year online. Whereas before, if you did that same commercial and they air it every time on television, you make a nice sum of money.
Right.
You know, I could live on that one commercial all year,
mm-hmm.
but that's not happening these days. It's so hard to get a book a job now that actually gets on air play. You know, and that's because of the way everything's changing too in the world.
Sure.
So, being in L.A., I know you should have some stories about working for some probably well-known names. Any?
You read the book. Which one did you like?
Let's talk about Madge, Madonna.
Oh, Madge. Well, you know, I didn't work directly for her. I worked for the costume designer, Marlene Stewart, who was hired to do the Blonde Ambition Tour along with Jean-Paul Gaultier. And
oh, yeah.
Yeah. So you remember those bullet bras that she wore and the Like a Virgin number? Because I know they filmed that. Well, anyway, Marlene was a friend of a friend, and I barely knew her. And she was having trouble with Madonna because Madonna was upset that she accepted a second offer to work for Oliver Stone on the Doors movie. He hired her as the head designer for that while she was still doing Madonna's, before they went out on the road, they were still doing the costumes at final dress rehearsals. Like before a big tour like that leaves, they rented a big soundstage at Disney and they do the whole concert, you know, including dress rehearsals and tech rehearsals and, you know, so the costumes were still being assembled and this, you know, Gautier was shipping things and then the costume supervisor was having to make duplicates and, you know, all that kind of stuff, and Marlene was in the mix. So Madonna was pissed off at Marlene because she felt like she wasn't getting her undivided attention, and Marlene thought it would ease tensions to hire me as a gopher between the two of them. Wasn't quite the solution. So little old me, you know, I had some experience working in wardrobe because of my knitting and design abilities. I met a lot of customers over the years, and so I had that little niche because I did my own, some of my own styling and stuff like that and videos and all that, you know. Talk about that in the book, too. I worked a little bit for David Bowie and some other, you know, people. So I showed up on the set after shopping at the downtown local Catholic diocese warehouse where they provide all the churches with all the Catholic paraphernalia that they use. You know, everything that you see in a Catholic store, you know, or a mass, you know, they sold all that there. So I was buying the robes for the priests and the crucifixes and the rosaries and all that. Because remember that Like a Prayer number?
I do.
Yeah. Well, I shopped for all that wardrobe.
Wow.
Brought it directly into the soundstage at Disney. It was my first day on the job, and Madonna cornered me in the wardrobe. She had never met me, but she knew I was coming with the goods because Marlene had told her. And she immediately started saying, "Did you get this? Did you get that? Did you get this?" You know, like all that. So, I mean, that was my first impression of her, that she wasn't, you know, the nicest person. She's very controlling. And I watched a lot of the dynamics on the set during rehearsals. But the best part I talk about in the book was before Gautier designed that bullet bra that Madonna wore in Like a Virgin, and that the boys wore those big, long, pointy cups, too. Do you remember the back of
them?
I had done a show 2-3 years before that, where I designed my own iconic bullet bra that was made out of leather pointy cups, but I actually had, you know, rifle bullets, like torpedoes sticking through the cups, so they looked like warhead missiles. And I wore that, and then my backup boys, and I was playing a hard rocker, you know, like heavy metal character in my one-woman show called Lowest Standards. and Lois was like this nightmare, right? And so she wore that bra, and my backup boys had cock pieces that were made out of the bullet leather, you know, cock pieces. And it was just, so I always thought that, you know, here I am, I'm always ahead of my time, right? I did it before Madonna, but Madonna and Gautier got all the credit.
Dolores, stick with us. We need to take another break. You're listening to Lambda Weekly on 89.3 KNON FM in Dallas.
This is Raphael McDonald from Resource Center Dallas. You're listening to Lambda Weekly on 89.3 KNON FM.
And I'm Dave Taffet here in the studio with Lauren Landis. On the line with us is Dolores DeLuce. Her new book is Blowjobs, A Guide to Making It in Show Business, or Not. And Dolores, we're just talking about some of the famous people that you had met along the way. And one of the people you talk about just a little bit in the book is Joan Rivers.
Oh, Joan. Yeah. Oh, sweet Joan, yes.
And it's interesting the way you talk about her. You talk about her. She's 80 years old. She's still going strong. And I know I never watched it much, but we happened to have on Fashion Police that Friday. And it was on, and there she was.
Oh.
And all of a sudden,
yeah,
she's in a coma that night.
Yeah.
I know. It's so shocking. Well, I was so lucky enough to see her again, you know, only like a month or so before that. She was in L.A. this summer. She just put out a new book this year called, what is it, Something Diva? I'm trying to remember.
Diary of a Diva.
I can't remember the
Diary
title.
Diary of a Diva, it was?
Something Diva. It's on my in my bathroom. I could go get it. Anyway, she was at Barnes & Noble, and I went early in the morning to get an early number so I can get online, you know, to buy the book so I could see her, because back in the late 80s, Joan had a she was the first late-night female talk host because of her, you know, working on the Johnny Carson show for all those years as his sub Fox News, not Fox News, but Fox Network hired her to do the late show, and she was going up against Johnny, you know, that time slot. And so one of, you know, she had a lot of problems with that, and, you know, that she talks about in her history, but she did one of the gimmicks they did that they came up with, the producers, I guess, on her show. They decided to do a contest for viewers to enter called Be Joan Rivers for a Day, where the person that's submitting the tape has to conduct an interview with someone. That's all you had to do. It was like, couldn't be more than 5 minutes long, and you had to interview someone or something or whatever. So I came up with the idea of recycling Lois Standards, who is like this drag character that I do, but she, like in the last story I told you, she was a hard rocker, but in this story, Lois Standards becomes a late night talk show host like Joan Rivers, and she has, it's like a very loose interpretation of Joan, and I do kind of like her character a little bit, and I come out and I have this late night talk show, except that it's so bad and it's on so late that nobody watches it, none of the audience shows up, none of the guests show up. So I have a one-man band, I have one guy in the audience, and I come out in a dress that somebody had designed for me for another show, I recycled it for this, that is like clear vinyl front shape, like shaped into an hourglass, like, you know, like the dresses Divine used to wear, filled, you know, with a fishtail. Well, all of that's happening, except the whole front is cut out in an hourglass shape and filled in with vinyl, and I'm naked underneath it. And I'm I'm a hefty gal, breasts and a big round tummy and everything. And so here's all my curves smashed under the plastic, like, you know, I'm preserving it from prom night or something, you know. And I have a little puff over my pubic area, like a little Afro wig and blonde to match my wig, and because I have a blonde wig. And then I have X's over my nipples. And so I go out onto because none of my guests show up. I go out into Sunset Boulevard and I interview hookers on the street.
How exciting!
But I casted the hookers. You know, they were like people I knew that played hookers, and it was so hilarious. And I get my daughter, who at the time was maybe 16 or 18, well, she's probably 18 because it's like 1988. She had just turned 18. And she looked younger, of course. She looked like she was like 15, little dressed in a little schoolgirl outfit. And she's hooking on the street corner. And I go up to her and I interview her. And it's hysterically funny. And I said, well, oh, my God, what would your mother think? And she goes, well, it was my mother who got me into this business. And it's almost like, you know, it's hysterical. So anyway, it's still on YouTube. Your audience members can look it up.
I got to go look at this.
Yeah. It's called, I talk about in the book, and I think that I even give the name, the title is something like Lois Standards Late Night Talk Show Host on YouTube. Or just Google my name on YouTube and you'll find it. But anyway, it's very funny. And Joan loved it. She wanted me to win the contest, but what happened was the Fox censors wouldn't allow her to even air it because of the frontal nudity. So she was so kind and sweet that she wrote me a letter to tell me this. Like, I would have never known. You know, I would have thought, you know, I was rejected. But I got a letter in the mail from her saying that she thought I submitted the best video of all the, you know, whatever, how many they received, and she thought I should have been at least a finalist and be shown, but the censors wouldn't allow it. But she invited me to the studio audience on the night they were going to introduce the semifinalists and then, you know, pick the winner. And that show, I was there, and she came over to us and talked to us, and she was very sweet and kind, and I thanked her. And so years later, you know, we flash forward to just this past summer, I knew I was getting this book out, and I knew that it would be invaluable for me to have a quote from her, you know. So I went, waited on the line with, you know, hundreds of other people waiting to get the book signed. And she was so sweet to me. You know, she took my hand. We took a photo together. I told her about, I reminded her of the incident. She said she remembered. Whether she did or not, she was just being kind, I don't know. Mm-hmm. But I was so happy that I had that moment with her, you know, before we lost her. Yeah. And the pictures in the book of us together, you know, that somebody took with my cell phone. She's just holding my hand, you know, and we're sitting there at the table. And she took the book to read, and I gave her my other book, too. And she was very sweet about it. I said, I'm sure you're busy. She says, oh, are you kidding? No, I'm going to read this on the plane going back to New York. And that's the last time I got to see her, but it was very, you know, close to the end of her life, which is amazing.
Yeah, that echoes. A lot of people may assume or think that Joan was like, you know, maybe a big B in real life because her comedy style is so doesn't hold back. But if you see her Academy Award nominated documentary came out about 3 or 4 years ago, it's a great film, and it really shows the other side of Joan, which is a very kind woman.
She's very kind, and so many people that knew her will tell you that story after story about how she helped them, you know. Yeah.
Well, and I know anybody who's interviewed her, you know, and you're dealing with just all kinds of personalities. When you're interviewing people, and, you know, we know that certainly, but everybody I know who interviewed her said she was just delightful to talk
to. Right. She will be missed.
Oh, I know. But I don't know, did you read the quotes that I wrote at the top of the book that I made up myself?
Yes.
Yeah, the one from her. Because after it was all said and done, you know, like all the celebrity names that I tried to get to give me quotes never came through for me. So I ended up making up quotes of celebrities that I knew and I had interactions with, and then also ones, you know, that are now passed on. So at the end of the thing, after I write all these funny quotes about them, that they're supposedly saying about me, I wrote at the back, these are quotes by celebrities if they were still alive or had bothered to read my book, which gave me permission to write them myself.
It makes sense to me.
Yeah.
In talking about celebrities, you know, and you've had a number of interactions. One of your businesses was a catering business, and so in catering, you're dealing with celebrities, even in their homes sometimes. But one of the stories that you told was really a very sad story, that you said Michael Jackson was at an event. He brought Elizabeth Taylor as his date, and you said they both looked so sad there.
Well, they did, because I felt like, you know, they were like royalty on display. You know, they take them out just so that the public can see them, you know, but they didn't look really happy to be there. You know, I mean, sure, it was filtered through my own experience of being there, working my ass off, you know, in the hot sun all afternoon, setting up the tents and everything in the backyard and the food tables. And, yeah, the chapter is called Food for the Gods. And it was the first time I'd ever seen Liz Taylor up close. And by that point, she was, well, Michael, too. I had never seen Michael in person either until that night. And they were the honored guest, because it was, the party was being thrown by some big Hollywood mucky-muck producer who had just signed some deal with Michael Jackson to do some kind of film project. I don't know what, you know, if they ever manifested. I have no idea. But all I know is they were spending $1 million. I wasn't the head caterer. I was hired by a friend of mine who also had a catering company, and she had some very big A-list clients because her husband was an A-list screenwriter, so she had a lot of connections in Malibu and all that. So she would hire me and my daughter to work on her parties very often, because she knew she had been a single mom before she married her husband and suffered, so she always gave us work, you know, whenever she could. And this particular party, oh my God, it was just so, you know what I mean? It was just unbelievable. And I was just wiped out. And then, you know, when they finally arrived, they kind of came in. Liz was on with a cane, very shaky, you know, and she looked very heavy and not very healthy. And Michael, you know, was wearing one of those, like I in the book, I think I call it Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band uniform, you know, that kind of look that he wore, you know, the jacket and whatever. And he looked like white as a ghost and very weird looking. And they just walked in slowly, and everybody was gawking at them and then down. And you know, and of course, you know, they brought them things to taste or whatever. But the, it was sad to me. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It's just
like,
you know, it's not like they were there to have a good time or enjoy themselves. You know, it was just like one of those functions they went to be seen, and it was political, you know,
that
kind of thing. So it was, they had that other story in there when we did, it was totally a different kind of party, is when Diana Ross turned 58 and we got to work that party. That was a really fun party.
Now, how was she? She's, you know, has this reputation of being a huge diva.
She has a reputation of being a bitch. That night she was not. She was very, very sweet to everyone, the wait staff and us, those of us that were in the kitchen. She came back and said hello to us, and she was very gracious. But my daughter, who was working the floor, because my daughter's young and beautiful, and they always hire, you know, they always put the pretty people on the wait staff, and then the older, frumpier ones get to stay in the kitchen. So I was in the cooking staff, and my daughter was on the floor waiting the, you know, tables to the celebrities and meeting Stevie Wonder and, you know, all these people, and Barry Gordy was there, and, you know, all Hollywood A-list as well as Motown, you know. But Viva said that her daughter, now I don't know which daughter it is, I think it's the one that's the actress and has that sitcom now, but I can't say for sure. Tracy, I think her name is.
Tracy Ross.
Yeah, I think it was her. And Viva said she was so weird and bitchy to her. She kept bossing her around and telling her to do this and go get that and do this. And Viva came back and told me, she goes, God, she said, you know, and I thought, well, maybe she was jealous of my daughter. My daughter's really beautiful, and she's also mixed race, you know. So she's half black. And I thought, well, maybe she was just jealous of my daughter.
We only have another minute. And I wanted to ask you about somebody who was a close friend of yours years ago. And you don't follow him through in the book. You tell the story of your relationship with him. And that is Roberto Juarez.
Oh, Roberto's in the book.
No, I'm saying you have that story, but are you still close with him?
Oh, yeah, we are still good friends.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I just got a Facebook notice from him to like his new page on Facebook this morning. he's still in New York, and he just did a big installation show in Miami. He's still doing wonderful work, and he's fabulous. He got married this year to his husband, who had been his boyfriend for like the last 15 years. They got married and had a beautiful wedding. And I was with them last year. I stayed with them when I did my book signing in New York. I went to visit them and stayed with them. This year, they were up in the country. He has a house upstate, and they were getting ready to do the Miami show. So I didn't get to see him this last October. But, yeah, we stay in touch.
Does you describe him as the Ethel to your Lucy?
Well, we would go back and forth. Most of the time, I considered myself Lucy and him Ethel, but sometimes he was Lucy and I was Ethel. But, you know, because basically when we went to Europe, they were in Rome. He was living in Rome for a year because he won the Rome Prize from the American Academy in Rome, and so I got to be his guest, you know, to stay in Rome in this amazing residence on Gianicolo Hill. I have these pictures in the book. I guess you saw them.
Yeah.
You see the one with me as the naked statue?
Yes.
Yeah, Roberto used that as his invitation to his art show, My Nakedness.
And I love that because it showed what a real relationship you had, because you described him, you know, when you were young and he was just starting out. You said, and his art really wasn't very good. So.
Well, in the beginning, you know, I first of all, you know, I wasn't a fine artist. I never had a lot of art history or any of that stuff. You know, I was just an Italian girl from Jersey. And Roberto had a lot of, you know, like he was always an artist from young, and then he got to go to the Art Institute. And so when he moved in with me in Venice, he was at UCLA, decided he wanted to go into film, and he made me his, you know, Juliet Messina, you know, like he was Fellini, and I his actress, and everywhere I went, he was always filming me and driving me insane, you know. But he taught me a lot about art, but I used to laugh at him because he would always have these big dreams of grandeur. I'm going to be rich and famous.
And he is very successful.
Now he is.
Yeah. Dolores, we are completely out of time. I want to thank you. The book is Blowjobs, A Guide to Making It in Show Business or Not. And give us your website again.
It's www.counterculturediva.com.
And we have to run. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Dolores.
David, take care. Bye-bye.
You too.
Bye.